Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
School may have been, but you can turn that around and make liars out of those bastards in exactly 1 hour, and you'll take that test and pass it and win.
Well, it's nice to think that an inspirational speech like the one in the movie Lean on Me could bring up test scores, but it's a lot more complicated than that. President Obama is meeting with teachers and school officials today to talk about reducing testing time for students. On Saturday, he admitted that there is too much testing in public schools. Here's a bit from his announcement in which he made in a video uploaded to Facebook.
If our kids had more free time at school, what would you want them to do with it? A, learn to play a musical instrument. B, study a new language. C, learn how to code HTML. Or D, take more standardized tests. If you're like most of the parents and teachers I hear from, you didn't choose D.
Right now, big city school districts are choosing D. They average about 112 mandatory standardized tests a year. Well, here to discuss the state of testing is Anya Kamenetz, lead education blogger for NPR. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you. Well, President Obama is calling for time spent on testing to be lowered from 2.3% to 2%. So not only does that not seem like much of a decrease, but it doesn't seem like much time, 2.3%.
Right. So and that number really is a symbol of how complicated this issue can get. The number refers to the allotted time for the state mandated standardized tests only. And those are the No Child Left Behind tests in math and English that are given in third through eighth grades once a year, plus once in high school. And that number really does not begin to describe the overall impact of mandatory standardized tests on our schools. And that is the reason for this announcement over the weekend and all the conversation that's led up to it.
Okay, so how important is this announcement, do you think? You follow this. You've written a book about testing. And what does it mean to have the president actually say there's too much testing, given the fact that he has instituted major programs that race to the top, for example, that rely on testing? In part.
Right. So, you know, there's two ways to look at this announcement. One is that it's really just symbolic. You know, obviously the president is on his way out. The Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, is going to be out by the end of the year. These policies for annual testing have been upheld. They come from Bush. They've been upheld through both Obama terms. And the version of the federal education bill that's in both houses right now, in both the House and the Senate, that upholds the mandatory annual testing. So there's no reduction in required testing on the federal level. That's the bad news if you don't like tests. The good news here is this is a major change in messaging. You know, the action plan, so-called, that the administration put out over the weekend uses the term burden no less than 8 times. And so what you have is the administration really saying, you know what, we hear from parents, we hear from teachers that they don't like how many tests their kids are taking. They don't like that school seems to be all about testing, and we want to backpedal. And so that change in message gives you know, candidates like Hillary Clinton some opening to talk about testing and possibly open the way to modifying both federal and state policy in significant ways.
Well, as he's saying this, we are busy implementing Common Core, which also relies on testing. So is this going to confuse a whole bunch of school administrators?
Well, you know, I think what it does is it does offer some flexibility. And so the watchword here is, you know, as No Child Left Behind is awaiting reauthorization, each state has a lot more leeway than it did in the past to create its own formula. And states are doing different things to incorporate not only high-stakes tests, but also other kinds of measures, things like school climate surveys, attendance records, behavior records, other measurements of school rigor, like high school graduation rates and SAT scores. There's so many different forms of data out there that schools and states could be using. And so part of the push here or the initiative is to provide a little bit of funding to do some audits and do some research and really do a review of the types of tests being used in schools so that schools can hopefully improve their quality. Now, considering that this is another obligation layered on top of everything else that schools have to do, you know, some may say, thanks a lot.
Right. They've just got their heads around all this testing and now they're being told not to bother. You know,
That's a really good point. You know, the Council of States Great City Schools that you just mentioned, the report that just came out said that, you know, since 2011, just 4 years ago, almost every district, big city district in the country, has changed its testing program in a way that makes it almost impossible to track changes over time. And so this really is kind of bewildering. And here's yet another curveball.
Well, let's talk about some other ways to measure success. You've written about this, and there are several interesting ideas in this. One of them is called, you call, stealth assessment.
Right. So this is the prospect that technology could come in and kind of deliver us from the onerous burden of testing time. And the way that this could happen would be through software. You know, many, many schools are using devices in the classroom almost every day. And these devices tablets, other computers have the ability to track student learning over time. And instead of having a single occasion of testing, you could be asking questions in the classroom every day, just as teachers already are. And that type of just-in-time formative assessment could then be kind of added up over time for a much richer picture of student achievement.
So students wouldn't actually sit down at a set time and fill in bubbles. They would be constantly monitored and constantly tested?
Well, that's exactly right. And the analogy used in my book is, you know, businesses used to have to shut down at the end of the year to take inventory and to go through paper records. And that's essentially what we do with our schools today. We shut them down. And so instead, you know, couldn't we have some kind of just-in-time scanning system that really is monitoring how students are doing and providing that information back to students and to parents and teachers in a timely way?
And there are places that have been doing this for years, maybe not in a high-tech way, but they've been monitoring classrooms. Scotland, for example, doesn't have many standardized tests and has this kind of in-person monitoring system instead.
Yeah, I find this really interesting. I read about Scotland's accountability system, and of course, it's a small country. But what they really have done is they devolved a lot of the responsibility for assessment onto the schools and onto individual teachers. And then they have this sort of inspection system that is made up of teachers that go around from school to school, and they really work with the schools to create improvement plans and to monitor, as you say, and pull the different kinds of results so that we can take student work, authentic student work, and use it to see how students are doing on a comparative basis.
And then there are other ways to rate students, not just in terms of how much knowledge they've amassed and acquired and are able to spew back, but different things like emotional skills, social skills.
Yeah, I mean, this is really one of the most exciting areas, I think. You know, there's such a big conversation right now about 21st century skills, all the skills that are not academic that are so important for success, like grit, growth mindset. And so the thinking here is not that you're going to create high stakes measurements for those for individuals, but what you're really going to try to do is assess how a school is doing as an overall ecosystem or environment. Are the teachers, are the kids, are the administrators happy? Are they engaged? Is there a high level of well-being within the school? And is the school functioning well as an environment where students, you know, feel motivated and feel inspired and that someone there cares about their progress? And these are actually ending up being very high stakes, very important indicators that we can measure, not with traditional tests, but with instruments like surveys.
Anya Kamenetz, lead education blogger for NPR and author of the book, The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. Thanks, Anya.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's look at how the testing mania is playing out here in California and in Los Angeles. John Rogers is professor of education at UCLA, where he also directs the Institute for Democracy, Education, and Access. Welcome back, John.
Hi, Madeline.
All right. The president says public school students spend too much time taking tests. So that must be true here in California and here in Los Angeles, right?
I think it is right, although the time for testing itself is really just the tip of the iceberg. We did a survey of high school teachers in California the year before last, and we found that teachers across the state reported that they were spending a good amount of time preparing students for tests throughout the school year. And in the 2 weeks before standardized testing, they spend a lot of time. Now, what was interesting was teachers in high-poverty schools spent far more time on test preparation than teachers in more affluent schools. So over the course of a school year, about 8 days were spent just on test preparation in high-poverty schools, and about 4 days were spent in more affluent schools.
And why is more time spent in poverty schools, high-poverty schools?
In part because of the ways that the federal and state accountability structure has worked. High-poverty schools have tended to perform less well on the standardized tests for a variety of different reasons, oftentimes having to do with conditions outside of the schools that make it hard for educators to do their work well. And because they have not performed as well, they've been more likely to face a set of accountability penalties that then prompt even greater attention on testing so that teachers feel more stressed to make the tests go well. What's interesting is that in these high-poverty schools, about a quarter of the teachers said that after the standardized tests, their instruction changed dramatically. And what that suggests to me is that testing really has skewed the teaching and learning process, particularly in high-poverty schools.
Their teaching changed dramatically after the test for the better?
Well, it changed sometimes for the better. More importantly, it changed. They began to introduce more creative and critical thinking activities. They began to introduce ideas that they felt like they couldn't do before the standardized test because that material wouldn't have been covered on the test themselves.
Okay, so we just heard of a bunch of alternatives from Anya in terms of testing and how we can test differently or measure differently.
Right.
But isn't part of this testing mania, isn't this because parents have demanded it, voters have demanded it, that they see this as pretty much the best way to rate the effectiveness of schools and of teachers and of districts?
Well, it's clear that parents have gotten the signal that over the last 30 years, the so-called wage premium to education has increased substantially. In other words, the amount that people with a college education earn relative to the amount that people with a high school education earn, that gap has grown substantially. And so parents across the board are very concerned with the quality of education their children are receiving and whether their children are on a pathway to college. Whether their children or not have that high-quality education, a lot of parents want better information. They've looked at tests as one signal of that. I don't think that parents and the broader public are necessarily committed to test scores per se as the only signal. It's just all that they've been provided with.
Mm. All right. So this year, California adopted a new statewide test based on Common Core, and the results came out last month, and they were pretty bad. 44% of California students had proficiency in English, 34% in math, and students in LAUSD were below those averages. So the tests, in that sense, can they be useful in revealing what more we need to do in terms of instruction, or do you think that they aren't measuring what students are learning accurately?
I think that the good news about the Common Core assessments is that they're pointing in a different sort of direction. They're trying to capture a broader range of student learning. They're trying to capture some of the critical and creative thinking skills that the broader public is interested in, that educators have been talking about. And to the extent that they do that, it's a positive step because then the assessments are getting at what we want young people to be doing. To the extent that they are marking off a new pathway in terms of assessment, it's not entirely surprising that students would be struggling to do well on those assessments. And it suggests that we need, as a state, to provide high-quality teacher development so that teachers are better prepared to provide that sort of instruction to all students.
So the teachers were better at teaching for the standardized tests than for the Common Core tests, is what you're saying?
And what we've seen over time is that any time a new assessment is brought in, any time a new test is brought in, it takes a few years for the system as a whole to develop the capacity to prepare young people for that assessment. To the extent that you're just preparing people for the test, that's not a good thing. To the extent that you're preparing students to perform well on the test and perform in ways that demonstrate that they really have these creative and critical thinking skills, that can be a good thing.
You know, some people have said do away with tests entirely. What do you think of that?
I think you want to have assessments of some sort. It's important for educators to know what their students are doing and what some students are doing well and other students are not doing well, and to learn from that so that they can improve their instruction. It's important for parents to know how their children are doing. It's important for the broader public to know how well our school is doing. The problem has become that we've used tests in a very reductionist way. And what we want to do is have a whole set of different measures that allow us to know what our schools are doing and to what extent are schools doing the sort of work that we believe and value.
And what do you make of some parents who say, I'm going to opt out. I'm going to opt out my kid from taking these standardized tests?
You know, it's interesting, in California thus far, the schools where that has happened has been in the most affluent communities in the state. Not exactly sure what to make of that. I think that parents have been frustrated when tests have been taken away from meaningful teaching and learning. That's what parents want. That's what students want. And I think to the extent that they're communicating that, that's an important signal to send. We want better assessments, and we want assessments to be in their rightful place. We don't want them to become the stand-in for teaching itself.
Mm-hmm. And so do you see what President Obama said as a watershed moment? Do you see this as a beginning of a sea change on a national level?
I think it's a hopeful sign. In effect, the administration has been all in on high-stakes testing in ways that I think have been very problematic, and in ways that might reflect the fact that the administration, in a time of recession, didn't feel like they had many different chips to play in terms of school improvement. Now, in a time when there is more resources to potentially use to improve education, the administration is acknowledging that they went too far in on the high-stakes testing and that there are other strategies to build the broader capacity of our educational system to improve teaching and learning for all students.
John Rogers, professor of education at UCLA, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Madeline.
All right, what do you think? Is testing the best way to evaluate students, teachers, and schools? Is there another better way? Would you like to just get rid of it entirely? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can tell us what you think on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, there's lots of diversity on your TV screen these days, but not so much in writers' rooms. We'll have that story next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry, you can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The TV show Empire recently introduced a new character, a scheming lawyer named Thirsty Rawlings.
Friends call me Thirsty. I think I could be of some service.
You got a lawyer, man. Thank you.
I don't doubt that. But if you don't mind me asking, when last time they got you a bail hearing?
And where did you go to law school, Mr. Rawlings?
University of Guam.
As for the actor who plays Thirsty, you might know him better as Bubbles from The Wire. His name is Andre Royo, and Slate writer Aisha Harris argues in a recent piece that his performance on Empire is so good, it's time for TV fans to forget about Bubbles and say hello to Thirsty. She joins us now to talk about this and other small screen news in our regular Monday TV segment. Hi, Aisha. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, so yeah, I just saw him and I thought Bubbles. And can we ever unthink Bubbles when we see him?
I don't think it's really possible. I wrote in the piece that I've tried and it hasn't worked. But that's our own hangups. Like, it's impossible to, if you're a fan of The Wire, or even if you've never even seen The Wire, you could still see him and just think, oh, that's Bubs from The Wire. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I just think that it's good to see him in this role and see how good of an actor he is by the fact that he's nothing like Bubbles in the show.
So this show has really a string of flashy guest stars. Chris Rock is in it, for example,
yeah.
Marissa Tomei. And I think some upcoming guest stars include Mariah Carey.
Yeah. If you know Lee Daniels, he's, especially his last movie, The Butler, had a bunch of huge stars in it. Mariah Carey was also in that in a mm-hmm. very small role. He had Forest Whitaker. He had David Oyelowo, Oprah Winfrey, Terrence Howard. So, like, it's not that surprising. And I think that Andre Royo's character so far is by far the best special guest star. Marissa Tomei has been okay, but she's kind of popped in and out and hasn't been a consistent presence in the way that Andre Royo's character has been on Empire.
And how are you rating the second season so far?
I'm still thoroughly entertained, and I look forward to it every week. I do kind of worry, though, that it's going to at some point implode and, like, not really know what to do with itself. It's kind of moving in a direction that seems very similar in many ways to last season and kind of repetitive. So I wonder how they're going to kind of work themselves out of, like, this sort of not a rut, but this sort of repetitiveness that seems to be happening.
Okay, you also wrote a piece that really looked at diversity behind the scenes in the writer's room. Of course, we've talked a lot about diversity on screen. It seems to be mm-hmm. Happening more and more now with shows like Empire, shows like Blackish, Jane the Virgin. But behind the scenes, who's writing these shows?
Well, you know, for a show like Empire or a show like Scandal, the TV writers room seem to be pretty diverse, which is refreshing. Lee Daniels infamously said a few months ago how he, like, hates when white writers write for black actors and characters. So he purposely has, like, an actual, which is rare in Hollywood, a majority black and Latino writers room, and the minority is white. But overall, nothing much has changed behind the scenes. We still have majority white writers rooms. We still have very limited space for people of color. And I think that in order for things to stay diverse on screen, we need to get more people in the writers' rooms who are not white and male.
And there are a lot of fellowships, though, that try to promote diverse writing staffs. Are those
right.
successful?
Well, as I wrote in my piece, they are being relied on too heavily. The problem with these fellowships and programs is that a lot of them at the major networks they give writers one slot, people of color one slot on each of these shows. And the way it works is that the network is paying for these writers and it's not coming out of the show's budget. So right off the bat, they're seen as these diversity hires. And it's seen as, like, this sort of affirmative action in a negative way where, like, they don't deserve to be there. And there's no matriculation. It's harder to matriculate up if everyone sees you as just, like, the writer for hire for the diverse hire. So the problem is that people are getting stuck. People of color are getting stuck in these staff writer roles and aren't matriculating up as much into the more powerful roles, where you have producer, showrunner, the Shonda Rhimes, the Ryan Murphys. So it's working a little bit, but it's not working nearly enough. And in order to fix things, we have to not rely so heavily on these programs and these sort of slots meant for people of color.
So the Shonda Rhimes effect, it's real. Correct. I
yes.
mean, at least it's real for her shows,
yeah.
but it's been real for other shows too, right? You write that she has had an effect on making other networks and other producers consider minority casts and minority themed shows. Jane the Virgin, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I think that she has done so much. And I mean, it's been written about everywhere. I think anyone who follows TV by this point knows that she's just, like, probably, if not the most powerful showrunner, one of the most powerful showrunners in Hollywood, regardless of their race or gender. And I think that her activism and her willingness to speak about these things in public, and the fact that her writers' rooms are very diverse, I think that she has helped push things forward for people of color. And I hope to see more of an effect. And I think Empire is also kind of helping with that as well.
Well, our network's saying, look, we've got hits here with Jane the Virgin, with Empire, with Shonda Rhimes shows. Do we now need to make an extra effort to hire minority writing staffs to make sure that there are more of these shows out there? Is that now a conversation happening in Hollywood?
It seems to be. There's a piece in The Hollywood Reporter, I think a week or two ago, written by an anonymous black TV screenwriter. And he or she talked about how they, like, now every time they're getting those meetings, they're getting the meetings that they wouldn't have gotten before with, you know, producers and showrunners and studio execs. But in those meetings, they want to, like, they're always looking for the next Empire.
Right. And then so I guess what you're saying is that once, if the fad goes away with these kinds of shows like Empire and Black-ish, then that'll be it?
That's the fear. I think that's the fear. And I think we can always slip back. I mean, if you look back at the 90s, there was this like wave of black shows, on, especially on Fox. You had Martin, you had In Living Color, you had Living Single. Mm-hmm. All of these shows you could point to. And then somewhere around the early aughts, it just kind of all dropped off.
So what's to prevent that?
Well, again, it's making sure that we get showrunners and executive producers who are people of color. I do think that that's really the only the way that we can improve. Another one is the Rooney Rule, which several people have also suggested. The Rooney Rule has been in the NFL for about, I'd say, 12 or 13 years now, and that rule kind of requires the NFL, anytime there's a head coaching position that's opened, you have to at least interview a person of color for the spot. It hasn't made a huge impact. There has definitely been a notable increase in the number of non-white head coaches in the NFL since that rule was implemented. Part of the problem is that the showrunners and execs often say, you know, I'm looking at a pool of writers and most of them are white and male, so I have no one to choose from. So if we, you know, kind of insist that they have to interview at least one person of color, then, you know, you can't make that excuse anymore that you can't find someone, because there's someone you can choose from.
Well, Lee Daniels found people and Shonda Rhimes found people. So they're out
there. Yes, they did.
Right?
Yes, they're definitely out there.
Aisha Harris, staff writer for Slate. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll continue this conversation on diversity and focus it on the boardroom and the connection between sci-fi writer J.G. Ballard and punk and new wave music.
I would say, you know, there's only a handful of authors that have really inspired as much music as Ballard has.
Now, one writer managed to capture the imagination of many musicians after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, we just heard about diversity in the writer's room, but the boardrooms of major entertainment companies have a lot of work to do as well. Companies like Sony, Viacom, Comcast. Women fill only about 18% of the board seats. The boardroom is the height of power and influence in Hollywood. Kim Masters is editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business, and she wrote about women in Hollywood boardrooms for The Hollywood Reporter. Hi, Kim.
Hey, Madeline.
18%. Well, that's not 50%.
not even close.
How does
no.
it fit with other boardrooms?
Well, yes, the piece I wrote was actually about women serving on boards generally public company boards, not charitable boards. Mm-hmm. And it fits pretty much. I mean, the number of women on public company boards generally is less than 20% and has been pretty stuck for a long time, very incremental progress in the last decade.
And so when you're talking about boardrooms in Hollywood, what is it that a board does?
You know, it's not like there's a one-size-fit-all kind of mission for boards. Boards are meant to oversee a company, ensure its survival into the future. How they do that exactly varies from company to company. You have a company like Viacom. Viacom, the shareholders are controlled by a frail 92-year-old billionaire, Sumner Redstone, and the company has been in kind of free fall for some time now, and yet the board doesn't seem to be able to do much because the stock is controlled by this person who is probably, I would guess, not even attending the board meetings. So, or, mm-hmm. you know, theoretically on the phone, kind of whatever. So then there are other boards where, you know, there is a lot more involvement. You know, the women I talked to just had varying ideas of what the role is, whether you are overseeing current strategy, looking at the future. But the general proposition is make sure this company is in good shape and survives.
So why is it important to have women on the boards and a diverse slate of board members?
Well, there's research that shows by a number of metrics that having increasingly diverse boards is good for the bottom line by a number of measures. So it's kind of odd. You know, I talked to Barry Diller, whose company is IAC, and he said it was odd to him that it's not more obvious that this is a good thing and that it takes so long. But, you know, we have an anecdote in the story I wrote about Melody Hobson, who is the chairman of the DreamWorks Animation Board, seeing a screening of Megamind before it was released in 2010, and the only person to notice that there was no one of color in a movie set in a major metropolitan area in the United States. And she's the only one who said, well, wait a minute, how is it that the only person of color in this movie is an alien who is blue? And Jeffrey Katzenberg, who's founder of DreamWorks Animation, promised her it will never happen again. And then subsequently Home, their most recent movie, the central character was a young girl of color. So people from diverse backgrounds can see things that maybe that are not obvious to, you know, there's not just one mindset in the room. And yet boards tend to be based on the selection process tends to be very influenced by who you know. So obviously people tend to know people who are like them.
Yeah. So how do you get on a board? Is it just your friend saying to you, another friend, hey, you want to join the board of X company?
Again, not everybody saw things the same way. I mean, people like Sherry Lansing, who was in the article that I wrote, was recruited, and Bonnie Hammer, who runs the NBC Universal cable channels, they, in at least one instance, and Melody Hobson, were recruited by a headhunter. So there are headhunters out there who are looking for, you know, potential board members, and in some cases, specifically for women. But these women said they were wary of being recruited just to sit there and be a woman. Like Anne Sweeney, who used to be a very high-level executive at Disney, told me she was approached by some companies, and she could tell in some instances that, you know, that she ended up on the Netflix board because she felt their interest in her was genuinely having to do with what she had to say, what her background was, as opposed to, oh, here's a woman, let's put her in that chair. So how you get on boards, it depends. You know, sometimes it's a matter of merit. You know, Melody Hobson said she believes it is purely a matter of merit, and as she put it, cream rises. Other women said, you know, you want to kind of network, to use the term that everybody uses, not so much, you know, meet people, get people to know you, because even when you are recruited by a headhunter, the first question in the room is, does anybody know this person? So it's good to be known. Some of them said it's good to express interest, you know, let people know this is something that interests you. You know, what happens is you tend to, you know, the people who tend to get into that position, if you're a Sherry Lansing or an Anne Sweeney, you're in great demand because you really fit that profile, corporate experience and, you know, the kind of poise and polish that these women bring into a boardroom.
And then once they get into the boardroom and they are sitting around that desk, that table with all those men, what is their experience?
Well, again, it varies. You know, if you ever talk to Melody Hobson, she's married to George Lucas. She is a 46-year-old woman of color from Chicago. You know, you would not be confused that this is a woman who would sit quietly and let other people do the talking. She's very forceful. Some of the other women, I talked to Barbara Franklin. She was a Secretary of Commerce during the first George H.W. Bush administration, not George W. Bush. She's been on 14 corporate boards. She said, in the old days, you were, you know, boards generally were less activist and less engaged, and you were supposed to sort of just rubber stamp. She says that's changed. I don't know. I mean, as a person who covers the business, I've seen boards that seem to be more, maybe a little more assertive. But generally speaking, you know, an assertive CEO, I think, tends to get his or usually his, sometimes her way with the company.
And then what's in it for the women to be on these boards? Presumably they get some kind of compensation. So that's one thing.
They do get compensation, which can be quite considerable. You get stock, although you're supposed to hold it. It's very bad form to sell it, I am told, by Melody Hobson. You don't do that. You get money, but most of these women are already so well off. You know, by the time you scale to that pinnacle, you're pretty rich.
Yeah.
And it's demanding. I mean, you spend a lot of hours, you know, you go to multiple board meetings. Sherry Lansing, when I talked to her, had just flown back from Italy, where her husband was doing an opera, just to attend a Qualcomm meeting. So it's not undemanding if you're doing it properly. And all of them said you don't really do it for the money, but you do it because you meet interesting people, you have an opportunity to look under the hood of a company that you may know nothing about. And really, it is very prestigious. It's, you know, you have now gotten into the ultimate kind of old boy network, except hopefully now there are going to be some girls of old and young in the old boy network.
And so then once they're on the boards, are they trying to recruit other women onto the boards?
Some of them said they do. Sherry Redstone obviously got onto the board. She talked to us. Her father is Sumner Redstone at Viacom. She obviously got there, and she said she felt she had to extra prove herself because her last name is Redstone. But she says she has reached out trying to add women. And I think that they do. These women, none of them wanted to be the only woman on a board. Some of them said they wouldn't do it if they were the only woman. You know, they wanted to have company.
Kim Masters, editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business. Thanks, Kim.
Thank you.
All right. Sharing this boardroom with me is Warren Olney. Hi there.
Here we are. We have company.
Yeah.
Each other. We're going to talk today about Pope Francis and whether he is going to turn out to be the liberal reformer of the Roman Catholic Church that some people have thought that he would be or not. There has been a synod of 270 bishops and cardinals that's taken place over the past 3 weeks, extraordinarily public and extraordinarily bitter and angry. With conservatives against liberals and people from one part of the world against another in very interesting ways. Very open, and there are those who are critical of it just for that reason. It's one of the things that Pope Francis has brought to it. It was his idea. Now he has to make a decision as to how to rule on a couple of things that very particularly they came up with. One has to do with people who are divorced and then remarry in civil ceremonies. Can they receive communion or can they not? The other has to do with the way in which gays and lesbians are treated. There's certainly not going to be any gay or lesbian marriage in the Catholic Church, but what about their treatment and how should that be worked out? And the Pope now is the only one who can finally make a decision.
Oh, so he has the final and lasting
say.
Well,
he does. That's his job.
Okay. Must be nice.
Yeah.
Warren Olney and To the Point coming up at 1 o'clock. Thank you for that. And coming up on this show, the connection between sci-fi writer J.G. Ballard and punk and new wave music. That's coming up next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The science fiction writer J.G. Ballard was prolific. He wrote 18 novels during his career and published more than 24 short story collections. Several of his works have been turned into films like Crash and Empire of the Sun, and a new movie based on Ballard's High Rise is on the festival circuit right now. But J.G. Ballard didn't just inspire filmmakers. He was also a massive inspiration for a whole generation of post-punk and new wave musicians. And here to tell us about who and how and why is KCRW's DJ and recently named host of the best radio show after midnight, according to the LA Weekly, Eric J. Lawrence. Nice to have you back.
Thank you.
So a lot of people may have seen the movies Crash or Empire of the Sun. These are Ballard books.
Right.
Tell us about J.G. Ballard. Who was he and what was his primary preoccupation?
So J.G. Ballard was a British author. He did most of his work. His prominent work came from the 60s and 70s. He did die at the age of 78 in 2009. But he was an important personage, specifically in the British science fiction scene that was going on at the time. It's what they called the new wave of science fiction. It wasn't necessarily limited to stories of, you know, space travel or some sort of really futuristic technologies. It was more dealing with a kind of near future. In fact, he had a collection of short stories called Myths of the Near Future. And it was dealing with sort of these dystopian visions of what could happen in our urban society that dealt with kind of the alienation of being stuck in our cars or building these enormous high-rises and apartment buildings where we're all kind of balkanized. So he was a very influential figure in that burgeoning science fiction scene, but expanded out into the mainstream fiction world as well. Empire of the Sun, probably his best known novel, the one that Steven Spielberg made a film of, really has no science fiction component to it at all. But it was his science fiction work that really struck a lot of the young readers growing up in the early 70s. These are readers that then later gained careers as musicians. So his influence began to drift into other media.
What was it about him as a science fiction writer that attracted musicians rather than other science fiction writers?
He was, at some level, an early punk, in a sense, because he was dealing with these subjects that were kind of perverse and, you know, forcing us to sort of look at ugly things. The example, probably his best known of the science fiction related works is Crash, which deals with a guy that kind of gets sexual fetish related to cars that have been in auto accidents. And it extends to, you know, wanting to have sexual relations with women in these destroyed cars. And it really is just kind of, it's queasy stuff. And it was, there had been an attempt to make a movie for years. He even appeared himself in sort of a short film that one of his buddies made. But it was later David Cronenberg, a guy that really knows much about perversity in film, that kind of was able to bring out the film version of it. But he was interested to tackle these dystopian kinds of visions that I think were of concern to a lot of people. A lot of science fiction, you think about in the golden age of science fiction, it has these sort of epic visions of we're going to travel throughout the stars and we're going to encounter all these alien races and, you know, maybe there'll be space wars or whatever, but, you know, it'll be someplace far distant. He was more concerned about what's my neighbor doing? Mm-hmm. And, you know, how does it affect one when one spends, you know, hours every week, every day stuck in your car and driving on the road?
OK, so let's listen to some examples. You mentioned cars.
Yes.
Well, there's actually the song Cars by Gary Numan.
Absolutely. It's in debate as to whether or not Gary Numan himself had read Crash by the time that he wrote the song Cars, but there was actually a single that preceded it. There was a single from a band called The Normal called Warm Leatherette that had come out the year before, 1978. And Warm Leatherette was basically a 2.5-minute version of Crash. And it became sort of an unexpected underground hit. So Gary Numan surely knew that song.
I always think of Warm Leatherette as the Grace Jones version of
Correct,
Warm Leatherette.
Yes, right.
She covered it.
That's right.
Let's hear first Warm Leatherette by The Normal.
Warm Leatherette. Warm Leatherette.
Warm. Okay, what is a Warm Leatherette?
I'm not sure exactly what a Warm Leatherette is, but, you know, later lyrics include things like, hear the crushing steel, feel the steering wheel. A tear of petrol is in your eye. The handbrake penetrates your thigh.
Oh.
It's basically using literally the words of J.G. Ballard's novel Crash and setting it to this just robotic rhythm using mm-hmm. these noises that, you know, we wouldn't think of as traditionally coming from a musical instrument.
Leatherette.
So there's this new movie coming out based on a Ballard novel. It's called High Rise. And what is that about?
So High Rise is about an apartment building, a mammoth apartment building. It was sort of structured to have all of the conveniences there with its own, you know, grocery store and its own barber shop and multiple swimming pools and all this kind of thing. And things start to kind of go awry with people sort of getting in each other's business and becomes a Lord of the Flies kind of a scenario. The movie is directed by Ben Wheatley, who's sort of known for being kind of a button-pushing type of film director. So I'm very intrigued to see this film. It's just making sort of the festival circuit as we speak, but is scheduled to hit domestic film theaters sometime in the new year.
So it's very British.
Very
late
British.
Late 70s, early 80s.
Absolutely. Again, it's just a matter
really
of timing.
Happening. And there's a track by the band Hawkwind.
Right. So High Rise didn't have quite as much of a subject matter that was as appealing to musicians. However, Hawkwind, they were specialists in a genre known as space rock, a slightly more expanded version of hippie music from the 60s. They were inspired by the novel written in 1975. And so on an album from 1979 called PXR5, a record that actually features many songs inspired by other science fiction authors as well, they wrote a song called High Rise, specifically referencing the Ballard novel.
Flat block of two dimensions. Neon tote board to the sky, keeping scars of people stacked up so high above the ground. All they can hear is the sound of the wind in the antenna. It's a human zoo, a suicide machine.
Yipes. So that's uplifting.
It's funny because there was, in this era, there were numerous other examples of bands that were sort of using Ballardian themes in their music, ranging from the Kamzat Angels, a band that sort of take their name from a short story from Ballard, to the band The Buggles, who had that song Video Killed the Radio Star, that also inspired by a J.G. Ballard short story.
I thought that was inspired by MTV.
Well, it was the first video played on MTV. Mm. But yes, its inspiration came from, and they had, in fact, The Buggles had another song called Vermilion Sands, also based on a Ballard short story collection. So very much, there were a lot of these bands that were sort of dealing with sort of alienation in a way. It was funny, the Human League, a band that admittedly also took a lot of inspiration from Ballard, had another song called Blind Youth, which sort of refuted the notion that everything is all grim and dark. And, you know, and actually there's, you know, people, if you go out at night, you can actually have a good time. And so it was sort of an interesting sort of twist on that kind of concept that was just so bleak and so gray. But it is true, Ballard had this influence, and it extends really to this day, whether the artists themselves are very literally quoting Ballard or they're just sort of picking up on the same sort of themes of alienation that were popular in the music of that time. You know, one great example, I think, is Radiohead with their album OK Computer is just rich with this sort of imagery that Ballard was using. The first song from that album, an album released in 1997, is called Airbag and is basically about an auto crash. Yeah, there it is, cars again. Mm-hmm. And the deployment of an airbag. And so, you know, these sort of songs dealing with these kind of technological things, but also the dark side of it with crashes and accidents and that type of thing. Tom York, the leader of Radiohead, is admittedly a Ballard fan to the point that he actually prefaced the release of a later album, the record In Rainbows, by blogging various Ballard quotes on his website.
So even though he has been dead for many years, he is still quite the living influence on musicians.
I would say, you know, there's only a handful of authors that have really inspired as much music as Ballard has. You could argue that somebody like William S. Burroughs That was actually more of a technique. His sort of cut-up style has been used in sort of the sample technology of the world. But in terms of actual straight-up references and sort of thematic and using story elements, you know, I think he's up there with, you know, some of the bigger authors out there. You might even say only topped by somebody like Shakespeare.
Eric J. Lawrence, KCRW's music librarian and DJ on Sundays from midnight to 3 a.m. Thank you.
Thank you.
Julie Myers, I don't think your theme music was inspired by J.G. Ballard, was it?
I don't think so. The title of the track is Every Party Has a Winner and a Loser. So unless he's writing about that, eternal competition, maybe
it
does
sound
right.
Yeah.
Mystery solved, Madeline.
Yeah, well, that is the philosophy we should all live by.
Warm
anyway.
Leatherette.
Oh, yeah.
It is in reference to car seats, according to Vertilac on Twitter, which begets the question, what is a Vertilac? So that's the new question.
Okay.
Of the day.
Let's crowdsource that, listeners.
Come on. Tweet us at KCRW Press Play. What is a Vertilac? other comments on the show today. We talked about testing and whether or not we are over testing our children nationwide and here at the LAUSD. And Mary Kennefic Kopp had some helpful advice. She said if you feel like your kids are being over tested, you should be encouraged to voice that opinion on testing while the LAUSD searches for a new superintendent. It's the final week of community meetings on that.
That's right. We talked about that last week.
Yes, we certainly did. And that is a public service announcement here on Press Play. We also talked about women in Hollywood boardrooms and our friend Jessica Levinson, who covers election law or studies election law at Loyola, said that 18% of people in Hollywood boardrooms being women might as well be Congress. So it's not just boardrooms that we're looking at here. It's other high power positions like Congress. Thank you, Jessica Levinson, for that insight.
Just it's 100% checking in this room, by the way, in this boardroom.
In the boardroom currently?
Yeah.
Yes.
The only one that really matters, the KCRW Press Play boardroom.
That's right. It doubles as a studio. So if you want to weigh in on any of those topics, Facebook, KCRW Press Play.
Thank you, Jolie Myers.
Of course.
We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You
Warren
betcha.
Olney is up next at 1 o'clock, so keep it right here on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a fantastic afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.